Hello, Nikki Moffat. It's Kirsty.
Hello, Kirsty Rice. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, Nikki, do you think people have got the hang of how to leave us a voice message yet?
Yes, I think they're getting there. We had 3 messages this week, and there were 3 really great messages.
Woohoo! Oh, I love this. I love that it's not just our voices that we're subjecting everyone to do. It's everyone's voices.
Hey, yeah, and wait till you hear the book recommendation one of them sent in. It turns out you're not the only one who thinks about money and expat life.
Oh, hey, I've got the recording of G and I talking about money. It's quite the revelation, Nikki.
Excellent. Shall we do all that in the podcast?
Yep, let's do it. Let's make a podcast.
Welcome back to our new and improved Two Fat Expats podcast, where we talk about all things expat, whether it's screwing up our expat children, finding the best locations to live, and not blowing our expat dough. How's your big fat expat week been, Nikki Moffat?
It's been okay, a bit grim. We've reverted to situation normal, grey sky Hamburg. It's a bit grim again, but I'm still lasting on the vitamin D from earlier. We had a basketball tournament this week. All the Northern European international schools came to Hamburg for the under-12 basketball tournament, and I volunteered to make 240 bag lunches every day. That was fun.
Oh my God, I saw that picture of 240 lunches. It reminded me of when we made 500 hamburgers.
Oh, that was good. What about you? How's your week?
Our week was good. The usual thing, got to the weekend full of, you know, sleepovers and a house full of kids and a rugby tournament and a couple of really nice dinners. I had this really good night with some relatively new friends and they had a dinner at their house. Food was absolutely amazing. But both couples who had sort of married someone from a different country and, you know, we had a Kiwi married to a Scot and, yeah, and then another Kiwi married to an Irish woman. Anyway, I just sort of loved hearing their stories. You know, those how we got together stories are always really interesting, although I have to say Greg and I did give each other the side eye when someone said they'd got married really quickly and they'd been dating for 3 years.
Well, were you and Greg like 3 months or something?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Well, see, Sam and I were 10 years, so we can balance each other out there. And I have to say the get-together story, that Sam, that's he opens with all the time. Whenever you meet new people, that's the first thing. You know, he'll do some niceties and say, anyway, so how'd you two meet? What's your story? So
that's gorgeous. It's always a good convo starter, isn't it? So how did you guys meet? I think I opened the dinner with, so how do you know, the hosts? And then they sort of said how they'd met, which was good. But yeah, I'm with Sam. I think couples like to tell how they met almost as much as toddlers like to hear their birth stories.
Toddlers. My 15-year-old still asks about his birth story.
Okay, so let's kick off this week with our geographically challenged.
Kirsty, I want to kick this off with a message from a listener. Eliza in Jakarta sent us this message, and I'm just going to play it for you now.
Hi, Kirsty and Nikki. It's Eliza Harvey here in Jakarta. I love your podcast. It's been a wonderful help and support for me over the last 2.5 years in Jakarta. I was just wondering, can you think back to your first experience as an expat, because this is mine, and do you get better at being an expat every time you do it, and how does it change? Thanks very much. Bye.
Oh, I love this. I love this question. We've actually done a whole podcast about this before, which we'll put a link on the website on the twofatexpats.com. So this was the first podcast that you and I did together. And I think the reason it appeared was we were both very much seasoned expats and we wanted to talk about it. And I was really interested because you had just made a move and it was perfect timing to talk to you about, is it getting any easier? And, you know, I think, Nikki, my answer now would even be different again from a couple of years ago to 5 years ago to 10 years ago. Do I think it's changing? But I have a theory. I think it depends how practiced you are at the moving. So if you're in the groove of being at it, like at one stage I had moved 7 times, I think it was, in 11 years. I was very practiced. And I could do, and I'd had it.
Well, you're in sort of anti-anxiety medication?
No. Oh, and you know, I think about that. I think about who I was back then, and I think also I had all this bravado and to do it. Whereas long-term gigs kind of give you this chance to settle, and they give you a chance to hoard, and they give you a chance to get attached and to start planting roots. And, you know, pulling up roots is hard. And I've realized that I've gone from this woman who was, you know, not only did I move those 7 times, I had 4 kids in 4 different countries over that time. So I was, you know, I constantly, I'd either have a baby attached to my front or a toddler in a stroller or, you know, doing things. And I think about the woman I was when we moved to KL. So we had been in Jakarta. I had a toddler. We got told we were moving, and we literally had a month, you know, or a couple of weeks, I think it was. And within that couple of weeks, I got on a plane to KL. I gate crashed a babies group, you know, like that. And this is before Facebook or any of that. So I heard about it through other people. Oh, yeah, there's this group of women and they meet at this place and they do whatever. And I just went and bloody gate crashed it. I did not know a person there. And I, within that time, sort of walked in, introduced myself, said I might be moving there, got chatting. This woman said to me, oh, we're leaving. I said to her, do you mind if I come and have a look at your house? And she said, come home with me now. I went home with her to her house, looked at it, went, yep, this looks good. Let's do this. Said to her, we'd like to
We'll take it.
And then at that baby group, I, you know, sort of purchased all these things from people. Oh, have you got this? Have you got that? I said to the woman whose house I was moving into, we'll take your car as well. I mean, it's just because I knew I had 2 weeks and, you know, I wasn't coming back and we had to get this done. And so we did. We just sort of made it all happen. And we moved 2 weeks later. We were in a hotel for 3 nights and then we moved straight into her home. I think about it now and I go, how did you do all of that? But I was so, you know, I was just up for it and gung-ho and had the energy. And maybe I hadn't had the experience that I've had now where I could go, oh, but this could go wrong, this could go wrong, and this could go wrong.
Yeah, it's almost like the brashness of youth, yes. When I say it, you know, the early expat years where you just think it's all going to work out, everything's going to be fine, I'll just do that. I mean, that is an amazing story and I hope it's a chapter in the book. But I'm not giving up on the book.
You're not giving up on the book, and that's why I love you, Nikki, your faith in me that that book will one day happen. Yeah, you know, moving scares me these days. If I was going to be really honest about it, I think I realised when we moved house in December, when we built the house in Australia and we moved into it, I realised I had forgotten so much. And my children were almost more aware of it than I was, in the fact that I really thought I was going to move into this brand new house on Friday morning and then go and do the school run on Friday afternoon. And it was my 17-year-old who said to me, do you know, Mum, do you think it would be easier if we stayed home with you that day so you didn't have to do that? Because I think things are going to be busy. And I have to tell you, at the end of that Friday when I could barely move because I'd gone up and down and up and down and up and down the hallway so many times and, you know, my brain was completely frazzled by the fact that you have 7 different people looking at you going, where does this go? How does this work? What do I do next? You know, you forget those things. You forget that, you know, all the things that you have to sign up for and organise and get connected and be a part of. And, you know, I haven't been lost for years. I haven't walked into a new school for years. I can't remember my last newcomer's coffee morning. And, you know, how do I even call myself an expat, really?
Yeah, really. I mean, we should get a new word for you, a long pat or something. But look, I know what you mean. And I think I have a lot of opinions and feelings about it, but I think it's all the things that you've already covered. You know, it's the time of your life. It's what's going on. It's the type of country that you're moving to, the type of living situation you're moving to. You know, like you wouldn't have done that in Canada, gone to a coffee morning and then gone to someone's house.
Yeah, I would have.
But in KL, that's something. Well, they wouldn't have been in the mindset to do that, the people that you
yes,
met.
Yes, yes,
you would have done it, yes. But the person in Canada would have said, I'm sorry, I can't take you. You know, you can come and look at my house, but you'll have to speak to my realtor.
Yes.
Or, you know, it's a different thing. Whereas in KL, it's all set up for, okay, sure, this sounds good. This person's going to take over our house. That saves us, you know, looking for someone else, et cetera.
Yeah, you're right.
It's just a different time. I mean, I'm not saying you wouldn't have done those things, absolutely, but it's just, it depends on the setup of the location that you're also looking at.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because I was thinking of more personalities that, yeah, I still had that personality, but you are bang on,
absolutely.
Bang on with it depends where you're going. And maybe that's the scarier thing too.
That's right. Well, this is, yeah. So, and that's, this is the first time we've moved to somewhere where not speaking the language was a big deal, and it makes it a bigger hurdle and a bigger step. But anyway, the group, of course, our favorite Facebook group, had lots of people with lots of good advice and opinions as well. Gail had said 30 years, 4 countries, 6 languages, and with each move, language, class and year, it becomes clearer that you don't belong there. So homesickness drifts off and understanding deepens, is what she said.
Yeah.
The frustration lessens as you learn some things are universal and some things are not, and then you adjust to that. So, and she says, no matter how great the package or the country, you always struggle with the differences. Things that aren't universal, manners and ethics. If you find yourself complaining that no one forms a line, it's time to consider that in the place you're in, you're the only person that's wrong and it's not the entire population. And I could not agree with that more.
Yes.
Because I always, and I think back and I do it every time, the first year in a new country, I'm always saying, oh my God, and what about this? And can you believe this? And what about that? And it's just based on your previous understanding of norms. And it's not necessarily the norm in the country. In sort of 2 years or into the country, you never consider that again. You don't sort of stand in a line and complain, or you don't, you know, worry about the concept of time in South Africa and that kind of stuff. So I think it's totally to do with that. Although I am never forgiving Americans for having the imperial system. I'm sorry. I kept up with that for all my time.
You're right. This is why old expats struggle with new expats, or why people who have been in a location for several years meet people, new people, and go, yep, I'm going to catch up with you in 6 months' time when you've got over your newness. You know, it's that whole, that fascination with a culture. And you're exactly right of people saying, you know, that day when you realize about standing in the line, that if you're the only one doing it, then maybe you're in the wrong place. It's not them, it's you. And I find that here, if I meet new people that are fascinated with the Middle Eastern culture and how people are living and opinionated about how people are living, I think, yeah, you know, I had this conversation 7 years ago, and it just is what it is, and I take it for what it is, you know, and that's what I'm here for.
Which is why when you're new, you need to be around other newbies.
Yes.
Because you need to go through it yourself. You need to go through it together. You need someone to talk about it. And people that have been there forever don't want to talk about it. They're done talking about it. They've moved on.
Kirsten D said that she sort of sounded a little bit about like me, I think, in that she said she thinks she's got worse, that she loved it at first and she was really adaptable. But now that she's a little bit older, B, has more experience of more places, she finds that certain places are harder to adapt to. One of her examples was in India, and she said that from what she could see, younger people who were on their first overseas experience just thought India was fantastic and colourful and interesting, and they never wanted to leave. And whereas she said she found it noisy and dirty and polluted and far more challenging than anywhere else she'd lived. To be fair on Kirsten, she had lived in Sudan, Uganda, Colombia, like she'd done some tough gigs. So
she said she just struggled to find the positive. So I get it with her. And also, like, she said that she thinks she was spoiled by living in Southeast Asia. And that's that whole thing too. If you've lived in a location where you really liked it, and a lot, I always meet people who've lived in either Oman or Hong Kong or Singapore who are like this, where they fell in love with the location and it takes them a long time to move on and get over it.
Yeah.
Whereas Amanda was far more positive, and she said, yes, it does get easier. That she said that last week she arrived alone for a four-month emergency contract in Istanbul, which is country number 5 for her. She said she was never, ever worried about it. She knew the questions to ask before coming. She knew what to get done beforehand. She knew that from experience that it would all sort of sort itself out. She said that in just over a week she got the internet but still didn't have her SIM card, that she had a public transport card, that she'd worked out how to use the washing machine in yet another language, and that today she'd got fingerprint access, or she was working on it, you know, for her visitor's badge. So, you know, and that's that whole mindset as well, isn't it? That she's like, yeah, I've done this. I know how to do this. I've got this all done. I think I could probably do with another move to, you know, for a reminder that I can do it. Yeah, but I really want to thank Eliza for that question. Now, on that, Nikki Moffat, how did Eliza do that question? How did she leave us this message? She went to twofatexpats.com. She saw the microphone on the right-hand side of the screen. She clicked on it and she left us a message. And we would love it if more of you did the same thing, because we love your questions, we love to hear your voice, and we love to discuss. So please head over to twofatexpats.com, click on the microphone and leave us a message. Now on to expat tech and expat relationships.
Okay, what have we got in here this week, Kirsty?
Well, I've kind of merged these two together, expat tech and expat relationships, because I think they belong together just for this week. I want to talk about our Google Doc.
It's our podcast.
Yeah.
If we can put it any way we want.
I want to talk about the Google Doc of doom that exists in my household, and that is the family Google Doc, which we keep all of our flights and our travel and our arrangements. So how it works at our house with travel, and as you can imagine, we have a lot of travel because I have 2 children in one country and 2 children and a husband in another. And we have a lot of back and forth with a child who's in year 12, who's got a few sort of commitments that she would really like her parents to be there for. And we have, you know, 2 kids here, and I have a husband who travels. So we have to tie in, okay, if I'm going to fly home to go to child number 1's school formal, I have to be back for the husband's travel, which happens the following week, and then I have to be back for another birthday, which happens another following, and whatever. And you can imagine, well, I'm being unfair maybe, with my husband, and maybe everybody else's husband is far more organized, but with my husband, he likes the whole, oh, it looks like I'm going to have to go to India in April. And you think, oh, well, that's interesting, because I'm not here for a lot of April, and we've got 2 kids on holidays in one country and 2 kids on holiday in another. But let's see. So we have this constant, you know, struggle. And then, of course, on top of that, you then have to book all the flights. I have a beautiful girlfriend, Christina, who does all of our bookings, and she, it's amazing that we're still friends with how difficult we are as a client for her, because you can imagine there's all this swap and change and move and whatever. And so there's a lot of emails back and forth with Christina. She has the Google Doc information shared with her so she can see. But it just got me thinking with, then on top of that, you have the visitors who are coming, so you put them in the calendar as well. Then we have 2 lots of school holidays to mush in, 2 lots of public holidays to mush in. We have Eid here, and we have Ramadan, and we have, you know, all the public holidays in Australia. So it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. And it got me thinking about who gets loaded with this job, who has to do this job in your house, who gets lumped with the task, and is it all part of that mental load? Like we've talked about the mental load before, if there's, you know, one person in the relationship who's thinking about school lunches and parent teachers and the electricity bill and whatever, is this part of that? Who does it in your house, Nikki? Like how does it get managed? And what tools do you use?
We don't have a Google Doc. So we tried shared calendars for a while. So setting up a shared calendar, we tried app-specific things, you know, lists and calendars. None of that really works. So I just keep it all on my calendar and I get emails or text messages from my husband saying, what's this date? What's that date?
Yes.
What's this date? And it's exactly the same as when we had a shared calendar and I would refer him to the calendar. So it's not really worth having the sharing because the messaging doesn't change and the information doesn't change. We don't have nearly as many issues as you have in terms of, you know, manage all the balls in the air. We're all in one country. And my husband doesn't travel that much, although he did call me yesterday and said, can you drop the car in? I need to go to Copenhagen tonight. and just throw me, you know, a suit in a backpack. But, you know, we have those. And, you know, last week he had to go to Costa Rica at 2 days' notice for the week. But he doesn't really travel that much. I think when people travel more often, it's much better planned. So because he does sort of this sort of ad hoc traveling, I think when people are in a job where they travel all the time, the company tends to be much more aware and managing of their time. I mean, I know couples where the working spouse is the person who manages all the times and the flights because they have it on their calendar and then they just say, okay, well, here's when the kids are off, here's when I'm going to take off, et cetera, and they manage it all and they just sort of slip it through to the non-working spouse and this is where we'll go and what we'll do. So look, I'm very Barry basic. I just use my Google Calendar and I've tried the sharing and it doesn't work. It's not to say that in another time I wouldn't push back again on that, but that's just how
we do a lot of, you know, what I would call domestic travel, which isn't the right term because it's a lot of international, but what I mean is we do a lot of family travel. You know, we've got the girls come back to Qatar twice a year for holidays. So, you know, then there's 4 flights to organise and then, you know, we go back and, you know, the other kids go back to Australia and whatever. So, but there's also the other thing, even if you're not doing that, that I know I have a lot of expat friends here who have chosen to make the most of their expat adventure by doing as much family travel as they can. So say they've come to Qatar, but they haven't been home for the last 4 years, but they have been all over the world. And I think about that organisation. You know, I had coffee with a girlfriend the other day, and she actually has a travel blog as well. So it's very much in her forte. I'll put a link to it in the show notes for you guys. But she was talking about, you know, they'd been to Jordan, and then she explained, you know, all the places they'd been to in that sort of 8 to 10 days. And I was thinking, whoa, and it sounded amazing. But then I sit and I go, oh God, the organization that's involved for that one trip, you know, because you're the one that's organizing that the driver's going to pick you up at the airport and take you to this place, and then you're going to go to this place, and then you're going to see this, and then you're going to see that. And, oh, yeah, we'll bring my mother along as well, so we'll get her in the country and we'll do this. And, you know, we've made sure that just the whole making sure everybody has a passport that's up to date and a visa that's up to date, we've struggled with that at our house. I'll be honest.
They're all very valid things. And I think it depends where you live as well. So when we lived in Hong Kong, all our travel was overseas because, you know, you can't drive anywhere. Yes. So you get on a plane. Yes. So it's just a different type of organized. Like here we drive. So because in Germany you have so many annual leave days and my husband always says, I can't take them. I'm like, well, it's up to you. You take them or you lose them. And the kids have lots of holidays. So he says, when are the holidays? And I tell him and he says, okay, I can take some days off or not. And so we say, okay, let's drive somewhere because we like to drive. We do. Our kids don't, but we're working on that. And when we go, we say, okay, well, kids, what do you want to do? You Google the destination we're going to and choose something to do. You know, that kind of stuff. Whereas when we went to Dubai and Bali at Christmas, like we walked out of the airport and the kids and everyone looks at me, so where's the car? Yeah. It's like, Everyone just assumed I had arranged the car to take us to the hotel. We went to this service department, which I booked a little bit late, so it wasn't, you know, quite what we would normally stay in. And my daughter's like, I'm not happy with this accommodation. And I was like, dude, I am not a tour guide. I'm not being paid for this. You know, like, there's a bed and there's Wi-Fi. I think you should be fine.
Yeah. You know, I always think of my girlfriend Lisa, where her daughter said one day to one of the teachers, you know, what does your mum do? And she said, my mum sits in front of the computer and books holidays all day.
Which she probably does, because it takes that long.
That's right. And it sounds so ridiculous, like that the beautiful thing of travel should become such a bloody chore. And I think it's not that the travel is chore. It's the admin side of it and one person feeling resentful. So I want to know, Nikki, is there a solution to this?
Well, I don't know if there is a solution, but I did have a little look around this week and I found an app, and it's called App in the Air. And it says the spiel about it is it's your personal flying assistant that keeps you up to date with all your flight, real-time status, airport tips and in-airport navigation maps. Your flight profile and all your flights are logged. So it works sort of across airlines and across countries, apparently. So, and gives you Apple Watch support. And of course, you can always pay for a premium subscription to get more options internally. So I'm not sure whether it will work for us because it's not on my phone, but it's on my iPad, which is becoming an increasingly included member of my hands when I'm in my bag.
I was just looking at it, you know, and it said that they'll tell you about gate changes and flight status updates and whatever. But I think most airlines do that when you check in, don't they? Like, you put in your mobile number and they'll tell you what's going on. So I don't know about that, but will it sort of give you like the calendar stuff?
Well, yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I would have to go in and do it. But what I was going to say is I don't know if it's any better than any individual airline app. Because individual airline apps, do you use individual airline apps? I mean, I don't use them now, and I find them very good.
Yeah.
And they send you updates to flights, changes of gates. They send you all those same things, but they're on an individual app. And, you know, they have your boarding pass on there, your electronic boarding pass and everything, and all your frequent flyer information. And so I have found the apps that I've been using lately, the Lufthansa, the EasyJet, etc. I've actually found them pretty handy, the individual airline app. So I would be interested to know, perhaps people could go to www.2fatexpats.com and click on the microphone and leave us a message about how they manage their travel and whether they use apps or calendars or Google documents, and if they share them with their travel agent or if they are their own travel agent. That's actually one thing I was discussing on the weekend. We had lunch with some people, and one of the things I said was there's so many travel agent shop fronts in Hamburg, in Germany. It seems like Germans still really go to a travel agent to plan a holiday. I think of other countries I've lived in, and I think you don't see travel agents shop fronts anymore. Like, you don't really just walk into a travel agency. Like, just down on the same block as us, there's a travel agency that's just for Australia and New Zealand. It's plan your holiday in Australia and New Zealand. And I walk past
it all the time. Does it make you
It does. Some days it does. And other days I think, why do you need a travel agent to go to Australia and New Zealand? And when you think about it, the Germans, they love to be organized and they love to be, you know, sorted. So a travel agent really actually makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Anyway.
A travel agent makes perfect sense for me, I have to say. I love the security of the travel agent that, you know that ticket's booked and that if there's any sort of drama, you can refer back to the travel agent. I get a little bit nervy about the whole online, you know, well, you didn't read subsection C that said that, you know, you had to be here at this time, or that you could only bring a, you know, a seven
pound handbag or whatever. You know, I worry about. I just love that sort of that feeling of having that travel agent behind me, and she does tend to think about things that I don't think about because that's what she does all day, every day. Do you know that's her job, and she's so into it. Do you know if there's ever any discussion about, well, maybe we could do this. Oh, gosh, you know, you should do that. And I did this last year, or some people were in here the other day and they did this. And, you know, that constant sort of thinking. So, yeah.
I've also heard you say before that you've received a message from her saying, I see you've got an upcoming trip. Would you like me to book your ticket?
It's time to talk about expat kids. Shall we have a listen to Emily?
Hi, two fat expats. My name's Emily and I'm currently living in London with my husband and four kids. I just wanted to send a quick message and mention a book called The Opposite of Spoiled by Ron Laber. I think I've done my kids a disservice and haven't really thought too much of allowances for them. They're 10 years and below. And I'm halfway through this book and it's really got me thinking about it. I wondered if there's any other recommendations out there from more seasoned allowance givers. The other thing I wanted to say is, Kirsty, your point the other day about being a long-term planner really got me thinking. We've been in the UK now for about 18 months, and before that it was Singapore. And I've come to the realisation with us deciding to purchase a house that there's a very real chance that at least the eldest, if not all of my children, will never go to school in Australia, and what that might look like when they head into university. Anyway, thanks so much for all you're doing on the podcast. Keep it up. Bye.
Oh, Emily, I was so pleased to hear about the book that you're reading. Number one, because it's on my list to read. Those who know, I work for a guy called The Barefoot Investor in Australia, who currently has the number one best-selling book in Australia, and it's all about managing your money. And he is right this minute writing his second book, which is all about families and money and sort of teaching your kids how to become hardworking, financially independent kids. So this book, The Opposite of Spoiled, that Emily mentioned, it really appeals to me. And that whole three money jars of, because if anyone has seen the cover of the book, it has three money jars with give, save and spend on them. That's very, very familiar in the world of the barefoot investor. Nikki, how do you do pocket money with your kids?
So pocket money is kind of new for us. I guess we started in the last 12 months or so. It can be problematic when you live this kind of lifestyle, how that works. And we give a small weekly amount that I mentioned last week we started using the app for. Everyone's very excited on the app. My son yesterday worked out how to put a savings goal on the app. So now his money goes towards his savings goal. So he's pretty happy about that. It tells him how long it's going to take.
What was the name of that app again for those who maybe didn't catch it last week?
The app that we're using is called Rooster Money. And we all have our own logon and I'm the controller and I can add extra money or take money away from them at any time. And of course, it's just all sort of online money. And then the hard money, when I actually hand over the hard money, then it comes out. So it's like I'm their bank account, really. I've always found it very difficult to judge the difference between what you do as a family member, so what your jobs are as a family member. So you should empty the dishwasher because you're a member of the family. You shouldn't empty the dishwasher because I'm going to give you €2 to
totally
do that.
Agree.
So what we've kind of come to in our family is that we all have certain jobs and they're our jobs. And if we take on other things above and beyond that, then there can be the opportunity to get paid. So for going and picking up the dry cleaning, going to the grocery store, sort of things that are a little bit extra to what their normal expectation is in our house, we've kind of come round to that's okay. And then last summer, my daughter was very diligent. She worked very hard. She earned more money every week than anyone in our house. And then she got over it. So now she's got a little nest egg that sits in a secret location in her room somewhere because I used to know where it was. I used to use it when I ran out of money. and have them put in IOU notes and have to top it up. And she was very unhappy. So it's in a secret location in her room. And she does things like she buys extra birthday presents, so above and beyond, and she bought extra Christmas gifts for everyone just from her money.
On to your point, because, you know, you've said things like going down and getting the dry cleaning and doing whatever. There are obviously things that bigger kids can do. And I wanted to say to Emily, I don't think you should beat yourself up about little tiny kids. I mean, yes, I would recommend the jam jars for the spend, save and give, because I think one of the most important things you can do with little tiny children is have them understand about the giving to others, because I think that's, you know, that's what we're aiming for with our kids when we say about them being less entitled. But I also acknowledge that it's really hard with little people, you know, for them to fully appreciate what we're trying to do. And maybe we have this huge expectation of little people. We didn't have pocket money for the same reason, Nikki, that you talked about with, I always struggled with, hey, it's your job to set the table. It's your job to empty the dishwasher. You know, it's your job to carry your plates to the sink. You know, I'm not paying you to be a functioning member of this household. So what we tended to do when they were really little was sort of look at things about appreciation and understanding. So you were allowed to get 4 sweets at the shop on a Thursday afternoon, you know, which of course is everybody else's Friday. That's our weekend, is the Thursday. But you didn't ask me for anything else during the week. You know, there was no walking through the supermarket and, oh, mum, can I please? It was like, no, you know, you get those treats on Thursday afternoons, which it sounds ridiculous, but it really put us in good stead for our kids. Like, they just didn't ask for those things. If we went to any school event, there was a budget. You know, you get 50 reals, and then when that's gone, it's gone. Don't come back and ask me for more. You know, don't ask me for tuck shop lunch all the time. You get it once a week, and every other day you take your own lunch. You know, you get one set of sneakers. We're not going to the mall to go and buy you X because you've seen someone else does it, because we do one shop for clothes and this is when we do it. So there was more of that. When the girls went off to school, and they had to have a budget, I think that's when a serious appreciation for money came in. And so how we do that is we give them X amount for a term, and they divide it up. Like, we say that it's roughly this per week, and then that you get an X amount for a term. But really they get to decide whether they're going to go heavy one week or light the next. Do you know, it's up to them what they're going to do with that money, but that money includes everything. It pays for their phone. It pays for their birthday presents that they've got to take for a friend. It pays for any outing that they want to go on, if they want to go to the movies or go and meet a friend for a coffee. So they really have to be really tight with their money because they're on a really tight budget. I think there is a real appreciation. I'm actually really, really happy with the girls. The other thing we did too was said you will have to work over the school holidays. So they both did an incredible amount of babysitting and got enough money that they both went into the beginning of the school year, you know, with several hundred dollars under their belt for extra that was theirs. So, you know, I haven't as yet, we're only in March, you know, but, you know, there's been no hit up. And, you know, I have to say they don't. It's sort of like, I guess Greg and I have been fierce enough that they know, you know, not to ask, that it just is what it is. I'm waiting for that first big drama, but it hasn't happened. We seem to be tracking along quite well.
Very good to know. So hopefully that's some tips for Emily, who has 4 children under 10, so she's got a lot of time to work with it, I think.
One thing I want to talk about, so we've talked a lot about, you know, that my husband G and I have decided we're going to have this whole kind of, I guess, money makeover, and I want to get more in control of our finances. So we had our very first sit down interview recording this week. And the reason I recorded it was because my husband and I
do not discuss money well, which is very funny when you think that I work for the Barefoot Investor. But what I mean by that is we're doing okay. It's all I know where all of our money is. I'm very aware of it. I know what goes on. But, you know, if we get into the nitty-gritties of talking about money, it quite often gets a bit, not nasty, but, you know, tense. It just gets tense. And are you hearing me, Nikki? Like, do you have this situation in your house? I thought, right, if I record it, maybe that will make us both be on our best behaviour and also make us be able to go back and go, well, hang on, you said that you wanted to do this or your goal was this. Do you know? Like, it was a much better way. Anyway, so we did it. While I was sitting there thinking, well, I know exactly where our money goes and I know exactly how this works, but there was an account that I actually didn't know existed. And I think, Nikki, this conversation is bigger and this podcast will end up going for 2 hours if we talk about it now. But I think maybe we'll do a little bonus episode and you and I can, after we've done this podcast, you and I will come back and we'll record and talk about it. But main things to tell you about the conversation that we had is my husband had geniusly come up with some great ideas on how to keep that emergency money safe. So having an account where it's not part of your checking account, it's not part of your credit card, it's not part of your debit card, where you have another online account that nobody could actually siphon because you've either got to go into the bank to get it or you've got to go online to get it. It was something I hadn't thought about, but it's actually really brilliant because that's what you need in an emergency account, don't you? Something like that gets used only in emergencies but also is completely safe. So I had a bit of an aha moment there. I also realised that I've really got to get in and take control of the money for a month. The burden that I put on my husband and the responsibility that he has, I think a lot of couples say, oh, yeah, they do it because they prefer to do it. And it's quite often not the case. People don't prefer to do it. They just do it because they know it's keeping their marriage happy.
I do it because I prefer to do it.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So do you prefer to do it? You don't trust Sam to do it or you need to have that control?
It's certainly that I don't trust him. I do trust him. There's a little bit of control in there. That's a very insightful comment, Kirsty.
Sorry, that's funny that you said that control, because I hadn't thought about it, but I said to Greg while we were recording this conversation, at the moment you have full control over our money, and he took that very personally. He took it that I was saying you control everything and I don't have it. And I wasn't saying that at all. I was saying, you know, you look after everything, you bear the responsibility of it, you manage it all. So isn't that funny how you can both see a word so differently?
Agreed.
All right, anyway, let's make that a whole other thing. But I will, and for those who are really interested in expat money, we will. We'll sit down and we'll break it down about which accounts we think you need to have as an expat, because what it's definitely cemented for me is that expat life is different. We expats need to manage their money differently because they're talking often about different currencies, they're talking about transferring money, and they're talking about needing that emergency account, which is completely different. But emergency money to an expat is we need plane tickets. We need a shipment. Yeah, we need plane tickets for 6 people and an air shipment so that we can keep the Mother's Day present, you know, that means the world to us. So it's a whole different thing. We'll do a bonus episode on that. That'll come out at roughly around the same time. Okay, let's move on to location, location, location.
So, Kirsty, in the Facebook group this week, Eugene Lee Clayton, who grew up herself as a third culture kid from South Korea and her husband is British. So she was seeking advice about settling on a home location, so a full-time, long-term home location. And it generated quite a bit of fascinating discussion. So Christine had some great advice about mindset that she was able to share with that group. And it's kind of generated a response from you, where you said, oh, Christine, we'd love to speak to you about that. So I understand that you did try very hard to speak to Christine about that.
Bloody Skype.
So Christine is an American who has lived internationally with her Swiss husband. And then 3 years ago, she returned to have Switzerland as a home base. And so when I was talking to her, I initially referred to it as a forever place, but she prefers the term home base. And we start the interview with her talking about what in her mind is the difference between a forever place and a home base.
So a home base is a place that you commit to being for an extended period of time. So even if you allow yourself the freedom to think in your mind that you could at any time change your mind, which I think everyone can, but some people don't do it conscientiously. It's just kind of in the back of their mind. So we chose to come here. We chose to settle here. We chose to immigrate here, actually, is the word that I use. And while still knowing it's a choice and we can change our minds. So that's why I would distinguish it as a home base.
Why do you think your move has been successful?
We decided it would be.
Okay.
I think a lot of it comes down to deciding that we are staying here. It kind of comes back to the immigrant mindset. We are staying here, whether or not it's forever, who knows, but we're staying here for now. And we are going to make decisions that reflect that commitment. So it's things like, yeah, we speak the local language. We conform to the local customs, except for when we decide we want to be different and other, then we just do whatever we want. But it's really this, I think it's just making a choice of saying, this is what I want. This is what I want to experience, and doing what you can to make that happen. So it's like the words that we choose to describe ourselves have affected like the actions that we're taking, which of course affects the experience that you're going to have. And another thing that really, really helps is I can't be bothered if other people don't like what I'm doing or not. If the locals are mad at me for talking too loud, I'm not bothered by it. I don't care. It has zero effect on me. And I also don't care if people who identify as expats are kind of irritated with me for not identifying as an expat or whatever. I don't, that's like a stupid example, but that's the only thing I could come up with right now. It's like, I don't care. I just have to do me. I just have to do my thing.
Do you think that's something that has come over time? Like, do you think that's a time of your life? Like, that's what I often feel about moving locations is it all depends on what time it is in your life, like where you are mentally, you know, what's going on in your surroundings, how old your kids are, et cetera, et cetera. Like, do you think that now you're in a place where you feel more comfortable with all those things, or do you think this is purely because of the words that you decided to use, or it's a combination?
Oh, absolutely. It's an experience thing, I think, because when I first moved here, I was in my early 20s and I integrated. So I didn't say that I immigrated, but I integrated, and I integrated so well that, you know, within a period of about two years, I had integrated so well that even the Swiss couldn't tell that I was not Swiss, which you think, yay, that's great. But it was absolutely horrendous because I completely lost myself. And, you know, it got to the point where I became suicidal, and because I was so out of touch with myself and who I was. And that was because I cared about what everyone else was saying, basically. It was more important to me to fit in than to be myself. And realizing that that's a really, really horrible place to be standing in. I, you know, psychologist once again, theme of our lives, helped out. So now it's really just about this, okay, What part? Yeah, it keeps coming back to what part of me am I expressing?
What advice would you give to anybody else in your situation? So moving to a country, possibly as a home-based situation, with a partner who is a native of that country originally. What's your best tips?
The one is about making a decision about which part of yourself you want to express. This is clearly for me one of the, I mean, anywhere you are, this should be one of your top things within the context of where you are. And the second thing specifically for this situation, though, is don't rely on your partner to do all of the legal paperwork and technical stuff, because you will probably ruin your marriage. Just not smart. So we had the advantage of, I lived here for a year and a half before he came back, and I had to do it all. So I had no choice. So I had to very, very quickly figure everything out. And that was really, really, really challenging. But now I can see it probably saved our relationship. Had I expected him to do it, it's just exhausting for one person.
What is your favorite Swiss German word? Because they're so good.
Yes. My absolute favorite word is Kuchikaschli.
And what does that mean?
It's considered to be the most difficult Swiss word to say. And it means kitchen cupboard.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's great. That's great. Kitchen cupboard.
I had to ask, because Swiss German is just so crazy. I had to ask the question.
Oh, Christine is a wise, wise woman. I've actually met Christine. She used to live in Qatar. My eyebrows were well and truly raised when she said, you know, if I'm too loud for the locals, because she's so quietly spoken. She's one of the most quiet Americans you could ever meet. So I cannot imagine anyone finding her loud. She's so centered and peaceful, and, you know, and you can tell from that interview, words are very important to Christine. She's a writer, and she obviously thinks a lot about the words that she uses to express herself, unlike the gauche Australian that I am, who blurts out so many different words without thinking at all. I was fascinated and also adored the phrase she used when she said, I integrated so well, I lost myself.
I did think that was a refreshing insight.
Yeah, it was. There were a few things with her move, you know. I agree, getting there first, having to do all of that awful, you know, the paperwork, the connections, the logistics, doing that on your own, I think as hard as that must have been for her, yes, it was probably a lot easier. I guess, like she said, it would save their marriage that she wasn't expecting her husband to do it, but I guess it could also tear your marriage apart in the fact that you're lumped with doing it on your own, because it's a bloody hard gig on your own. I think if you could manage some way to do it together, that would be the happy medium, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think just it wasn't able to be included because I did have to edit it down. But one of the other sort of thought-provoking things she talked about was the self-identity of her children and the fact that they are teenagers now and their reintegration, because they see themselves as binational, so they see themselves both as Swiss and American.
Mm.
So it was really important for them, knowing that they were going to live here for sort of a lengthy period of time, was to have sort of support in the reintegration. And as you heard Christine say, she believes psychologists and therapists are very important for that process. And I don't disagree with that at all. I think it's good. And in the Swiss school system, they have school psychologists who are able to help her children do that reintegration. So
wow.
I thought that was something worth mentioning as well, because it is obviously a very important part of any kind of move like that when you're considering it with children.
Yeah. So the reason I had become so intoxicated by Christine's initial response was she had said what a change the move had made to her by calling herself an immigrant rather than an expat. And you know, because they are two very different words, and I don't want to get into, you know, what is what. But I thought, if you even take those words out of it and think about the mindset that they bring, all right, and that she went, no, I'm immigrating here, this is what I am, this is who I am, this is how we're approaching it, which then kind of threw me a bit when she said, oh, but this is home for now, do you know, like we're not here forever. So it was like, oh, okay, well then have you immigrated? I don't know. And that's where words can then do us a disservice, can't they? So it comes back to mindset.
That's right. And words can be tricky, but the mindset is right. And I think Christine's mindset has been right, and that's really helped her family settle there.
Yes.
And herself settle there. And I think that whatever words we use, and I'm terrible with words, and but it is all about, don't use the same ones over and over, it's all about how your mind is positioned and where you are mentally. And I'm on board with that philosophy forever and ever.
Yeah,
could be a separate book in that, Kirsty. You want to use all your good words for it.
Okay, so this week, Nikki, we were going to do locations that start with the letter B. What did you come back with?
You'll be interested to know that we ran a poll this week as opposed to just letting everyone throw the words out there, and there are 90 different locations. So I have never lived anywhere started with the letter B, so I just threw five cities that started with B in there, and I left everyone else to add in. The top three were Britain, Brisbane, and Bangkok, and I'm going to eliminate Britain because I don't think that's cheating. I don't think there's any country or group of nations called Britain. I think there's Great Britain and the United Kingdom. And I don't wonder whether they'll be back for G and U. So I think we're double counting if we do that. I thought it was great. There were some amazing places like Bangkok, Brisbane and Bangkok were the most people had lived there by a mile, and Beijing came in a distant fourth. I did Google some more places this week. Mm-hmm. Places I Googled included Balmedy, if that's correct. That's in Scotland. Mm-hmm. A city in the Czech Republic called spelled B-R-N-O. I don't know
how to pronounce it. How would you pronounce that? Can someone please come in or to fatexpats.com and click on the microphone button and tell us, how do you pronounce the city in the Czech Republic that is B-R-N-O? Is it Brno? Brno.
I don't know. And Burgos in Spain. But anyway, I spoke this week to Candace, and Candace is a South African who lives in B for Bangalore. And she left South Africa 14 years ago with her husband. She has two children. They are 10 and 8. And when we started our conversation, she gave me a bit of a warning. If she goes missing, it's because the electricity's gone out, which happens a few times a day and more often as the weather heats up, she said. So we did get through our whole call without losing our Skype connection. So that was a win. The first destination they moved to after South Africa 14 years ago was Bangalore. But then something happened, so they left, and only to return several years later. So I'll let Candace tell you about it now.
Actually, I'm fall pregnant with my son, my oldest child, here. And nobody else we knew were having children, babies, so we panicked, but actually. And went back to the UK, so to London. And then we had the opportunity to come back, so we took it with open arms. Yeah, my husband works in finance. Actually, we both have previously worked in finance. This is the first time I'm not working, actually. So, yeah, when he was asked if we were globally mobile again, he came home with that smile on his face. And I was like, yeah, it was the US or here. And I was like, let's go to India. Let's go back. Kind of an easy choice, really, because we really loved our first time here. I mean, we were both working then. So it was a really different experience. Now with the kids, it's, you know, very different, obviously. The schools are outside. Right. So the kids have about a 40-minute bus ride each way. And they're at an international school. You know, that was a whole new world for us. And they're going through you know, some pretty, you know, poor villages, and they get stuck in traffic there a lot. So, but they never mention anything, actually.
So how can you tell if they ever got to school and when they're going to be home?
It's pretty well, actually. We have a tracker, bus tracker, so we can see where they are. I mean, I guess that's the biggest frustration frustration living here is the traffic is on the, it's just insane. We travel to travel. My husband's office is 13 kilometers away, and it takes him an hour and 15 minutes to get to work.
Okay, so what we're going to do is I'm going to ask the Fat Five questions. So starting on a scale of 1 to 10, rate your current level of in love with Bangalore.
Oh, probably an 8.
An 8, excellent. And would you say you're more in love this time or last time?
Definitely this time, yeah. I mean, I guess because I'm probably not working. So we get to travel a lot. I think that's, you know, the main plus, really. We're doing a lot more of that this time.
What's your best local find?
Oh, probably the shopping, the textiles, all the, you know, the clothes. Every week we're finding new shops. And I think as a group of us, we kind of go maybe once a month or something, go into the markets, and just amongst the chaos, you find amazing stuff and so cheap, incredibly cheap.
And what drives you crazy?
Oh, the traffic. Because it's just anywhere you want to go, you know you're going to be in the car for an hour minimum, yeah, the traffic.
Where's somewhere, not necessarily where you are now, that you never want to go back to?
It's a good question, actually. I think in India, probably, you know, we've traveled extensively in India in our 4 years here, and there's been, I mean, I guess probably... Actually, we did a weekend in Mumbai, and we had some, you know, we did kind of slum tour. I think that's the thing you do there. And I enjoyed that, but there were bits of it that I was not comfortable being like the only female around, I guess. Yeah.
What's the best piece of advice you've been given about your expat life or living in Bangalore?
Oh, best advice is just do what, you know, any opportunity you get, do it, right? I think when I first arrived here, there were people that had been here for like 4 or 5 years that I became friendly with really quickly. And two of the girls especially were doing, you know, yoga and learning to teach yoga and doing quite a lot of travel. And I now am about to do a yoga teaching course. I do a lot of yoga. So I think it was just take any kind of opportunity you can, because most of the spouses, most of my friends don't work. You're never going to get that again. So,
what's one place you'd love to live?
One place I'd love to live. Ooh. Well, I mean, I'm here. I don't want to live here long term, so I'm not going to say India. Singapore?
Yes, I think Singapore really tops the list. It's the best of a lot of worlds, isn't it?
Off the top of my head, I'd say Singapore.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned being an expat or living this kind of life?
Biggest lesson I've learned, you're thrown into like this, like sometimes I feel like it's a pit of people that you must instantly be friends with, you know, and I think it's to just like trust your gut with that, you know. You don't have to be friends with everyone that you're friends of, you know, friends with, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess the type of people you get here are really up for an adventure most of the time. You know, some people are, you know, they've been forced to come here, but you know, most people are, but I think it's taken me a while to, you know, to get used to that. Be like, well, you know, you can kind of get your tribe kind of together, if that makes sense, you know, and really decide who you want to spend time with.
Oh, that's fantastic. Imagine getting the opportunity to go to the same place like pre-kids and post-kids and live both lives, because they're always two very different lives, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that was one of the things I found riveting, and the fact that she immediately said, let's go back.
Yes.
When she had the children. Because I don't know whether I would have done that. I always talk about not being able to go back. So I don't know. I thought that was great. And I loved her tips. I loved her answers to the questions. I thought I had a really fun conversation with her.
Gorgeous. Okay. So next week it's C. So we'll be back in the Two Fat Expats Facebook group looking for people that have lived in countries and cities that start with the letter C. There's going to be oodles, because I can already think of about 10 immediately off the top of my head.
Well, I can think of one that you lived in.
Yes.
So there you go.
Yes. Just quickly, because this is a long one, but books, movies, telly, podcasts. Nikki, I'm going to start with telly. kids and I and G have been watching Blue Planet 2 this week, which is the, you know, the David Attenborough series. And we went straight to Blue Planet 2. I'll admit we haven't seen Blue Planet 1, but I really want to now. It is so beautiful. We have watched this series just going, oh, oh my God, what's that? You know, like through the whole episodes. Just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Last night we went deep, deep into the deep sea. And I had just assumed that because it was so black down there and dark and freezing cold that, you know, every animal would be dark and, you know, big and freezing cold. And instead there's just all these beautiful neon fish, just stunning, stunning. It's just a beauty to withhold, this whole series. So I would highly recommend it, particularly when, you know, usually most of my telly recommendations involve me submitting my children to things they really shouldn't be watching because we've run out. This is the polar opposite. This, pardon the pun, but this is just a beautiful thing to watch. What about you? Have you got any telly in you at the moment?
Well, telly, yes. All my shows are coming back on. Yay. And I've started back in with season 2 of The Good Fight. Uh-huh. It just came back. So The Good Fight, again, is the sequel to The Good Wife. And I know I've talked about it before, but it's still great. And I was watching it the other night in the aftermath of International Women's Day and things like that. And I thought about, you know, it's got three really strong female leads in the leads are all female. The male parts are secondary in the show. One of the female leads is in the, like, the over 50s category. One is a lesbian and one is a black woman. So I just think it's, and it's got just as many strong female secondary parts as it does have male. Yes. So I also think it's quite, you know, it's a pro-woman show. So I'm just going to give it another plug.
Yeah. Do you think you need to have watched The Good Wife to then watch The Good Fight, or do you think that they coexist completely independently?
They can coexist completely independently. It gives you a bit of background if you've watched The Good Wife, yeah, but you don't have to have watched it.
Okay. I want to
definitely not.
I want to talk about a podcast that I listened to only yesterday that I thought was brilliant. And that's back to the old faithful of conversations with Richard Feidler, but a particular episode that's called An Extreme Treatment for Depression. The reason I was so fascinated in this is I ended up with a very good friend who ended up in hospital with severe depression. And, you know, it just seems now that we have so many more conversations about mental health and anxiety and we discuss it more, you realize that so many of your friends are taking medication or battling with depression or battling with anxiety or different issues. Like, it's far more common to talk about it. But what had come out of this situation is when I'd gone to see her in hospital, in the psych ward, she talked to me about they had suggested ECT, which is electroconvulsive therapy. So it's interesting that when I think about ECT, I immediately go to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Jack Nicholson, and, you know, he's, you know, going through the experience and it looks so hideous, you know, people holding you down, wearing a straitjacket, the whole thing. But what my friend was told during her experience was, by, and this is by beautiful, lovely nurses who had her best interests at heart, they also said to her, you know, if it was me and I had to choose between having medication for depression or having ECT, I would choose ECT every time, which I found really interesting that we've obviously mental health is making a move and treatment's making a move. Anyway, my girlfriend did have it and swore by it, thought it was fabulous. And, you know, I look at her and her experience with ECT, and then I look at the battles of other friends who have spent months trying to get their medication right. Do you know, it seems to be the thing with depressive medication that there's this amount of time where you're trying to get all the bits and pieces to line up and the right dose for you to get back on the right track. Anyway, if you listen to this podcast is about a woman called Helen Elliott, and this the thing that makes it, I think, even more fascinating is she's a psychologist who's been admitted to a psych ward. So she'd had a life as a psychologist. She's a really incredibly busy young mother, starts to suffer from insomnia and goes down a path that leads with her being admitted into a psych ward herself. It is really worth listening to, and I would thoroughly recommend it. I thought it was fantastic.
I do have it queued up to listen to because I have had a friend that's gone through the same thing, and she's very open about it in her social media because she thinks it's important for people to understand and accept. And, you know, as we're talking more and more about mental health these days. So I concur and I look forward to listening to it. I did have a Conversations with Richard Feidler podcast to discuss, but I'll leave that for another time. We should maybe give people a broader spectrum of podcasts. One that I did listen to, but they're always all so good. You could just listen to them all. One I did listen to this week, Kirstie, and I know you think I have a bit of a penchant for crime. I listened to three episodes of a podcast called Case File.
Yes.
And there were three episodes about Silk Road, which is, and the story was absolutely enthralling and written in, the research and writing was just amazing. And it was just really written for the listener. So there's loads of articles, there's books about Silk Road, and I had read sort of bits and pieces, but this really brought it all to life for me. And this, it's three episodes, and the second episode is just such a cracker, like you can't stop after the second episode and say, oh, I'll just listen to the third one tomorrow.
So because Silk Road was the site where you could buy your drugs from, right?
Correct. So Silk Road was, it was birthed at the same time as Bitcoin started, and it enjoyed a very similar tumultuous ride, although it's now gone and the founder is behind bars for life. It was so just interesting and stimulating to hear about, you know, he set it up. It was based on his libertarian political beliefs that everything is a personal choice. So if you choose to have drugs, you should be able to buy drugs because that's, it's your choice what happens to your body, but you're responsible.
And we should be clear with people that when we say drugs, we mean like recreational drugs, not pharmaceutical drugs, right? Or was it both?
Well, there were also pharmaceutical drugs as well. So it was recreational drugs, pharmaceutical drugs. They went into a bit of gun running at some stage. Like they just went down all these different paths. It was building a business and finding different things that worked in the business and didn't work, which it's, and that's what makes it sort of riveting listening because, you know, the gun thing didn't really work out and they tell you why it didn't really work out. And it wasn't because you couldn't sell guns, it was because of the delivery mechanism and things like that. So the investigation was years long and by multiple agencies globally, but particularly in the US. And some of those investigating ended up going to prison themselves because of their involvement in the case. But the most interesting thing to me is that it was done by Case File. And have you ever listened to Case File at all? You probably haven't because you're not into crime podcasts. And I don't listen a lot, but Case File True Crime is, it was one of the first true crime podcasts. And it's a bit of an enigma because the podcast is just one guy reading and he reads a written summary of interesting criminal cases. And in the beginning, that was it. There was no music, no intro, no outro. It was just that. And it is one of the biggest true crime podcasts globally now. And there's a team of seven people that work on it. And the website lists two composers, two musical composers. So everything's scored to music now. Mm. And there's three researcher writers and a designer. But the host remains anonymous. No one knows who the host is.
Ooh.
And it's an Australian. So he's an Australian guy who reads it. So it's just one of those things. And to me, this whole, the episodes about Silk Road being the whole fact that the person who created Silk Road was anonymous for so many years and the fact that the Case File guy is anonymous, I just thought it all sort of, it all sort of came together.
Yeah.
And I found it very, very enticing listening. So I'll put the links for that.
Just on Silk Road, it kind of took me to that place when you were talking about Silk Road. It took me to that episode of Reply Hall where the woman who's a writer for the New Yorker comes in and she knows that she's got some Bitcoin somewhere, and the people from Reply All head down this path where they're trying to find that bit of Bitcoin, and you're waiting to see whether she has 10 Bitcoin or 3 Bitcoin or 17 Bitcoin, you know, which were up to, you know, in the millions of dollars. And it was all down to what did she do? And she'd bought, I think she'd bought some pot on Silk Road and had to use Bitcoin. So for the last, you know, X amount of years, she'd been walking around going, I know I've got some Bitcoin somewhere, but I just don't know where because it was on this old laptop. That's a fantastic episode of Reply All. Have you heard that one?
It is a good. I have heard that one, and I'll put the link to that one in as well because that is a great Reply All episode.
Yes. All right.
As most of them
are. So, Nikki, I've got book group tonight. I Am Malala is the book. So I will talk about that next week so I can come back and tell you what everybody else said, but I am really looking forward to book group because it's on my compound, which means I get to have a drink because I can happily walk home. And she's having Turkish food, so I'm very excited about that. Have you been back to your book group? What's your book group reading?
Oh, no, my book group's next week, so I'm going to have to look into that and quickly read the book. So I'll also talk about that another time. I think we've talked a lot this week, what's new, and we're going to have to do some tough editing, and I think it'll still be quite a long episode, so we should probably wrap it up there.
Okay. All right, Nikki, I'll talk to you next week.
Bye.